Hello. Has the product design obsession with frameworks and process led to everyone working on autopilot, churning out bland monoculture of design? When are they useful and when do they simply become a crutch? Have we hit peak framework? Welcome to Power of 10, a show about design operating at many levels of Zoom, from thoughtful detail through to transformation in organizations, society, and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a design leadership coach, service design and innovation consultant, educator, and writer. My guest is James Nell, founder of Path, a consultancy that helps organizations play the long game through design-led strategy. James was head of insight for pioneering service design agency LiveWork in the early years of service design practice, which is where we met. He worked on service transformation for brands such as the NHS, BBC, Aviva, Johnson & Johnson, eBay, Gov.UK, HMRC, that's the customs people, and revenue tax office, right? And led transformation design team at Westpac in Australia, where he joins us now, delivering their digital mortgage services. James, welcome to Power of 10.
Hi, Andy. Thank you.
So, first of all, tell us, I've got a little bit of a bio there, but tell us a little bit about your background and work before we get onto the framework question.
So I'm a design-led strategist. My background is in research. I'm a sociologist. That's what I studied. And I got involved in early days of service design from the research side. And over time, my practice grew to incorporate more strategy. So as I added more design in, I guess I've become more what I would call a strategist, or describe myself as a strategist. And I describe what I do as design-led strategy, rather than necessarily design strategy, because it incorporates a lot of different elements of a strategic practice, but always bringing some of the kind of elements of design that I think are powerful ways of working and thinking that you don't necessarily get with a very kind of analytic approach.
And so, you know, when you say it's design-led, what is sort of particularly designerly about, I guess, about it when you say those things add a different edge to a normal strategy practice?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We're probably getting quite quickly into what we've been kind of speaking about today, because I think what design adds is the ability to make leaps. To synthesize things and make jumps that don't necessarily follow a linear path, that don't necessarily go A to B or 1 + 2 = 3. Design is quite powerful at allowing you to bring things together and find patterns or synthesize things in a way which can be quite unique or different, and also to work quite quickly at synthesizing patterns. So I think design's got something to offer massively in terms of bringing things together in a slightly different way around a problem that you don't necessarily get when you're following something in a purely analytic framework.
We are indeed getting close to what we're going to talk about. I guess it's one of these things. There's a phrase, I think I've heard it from Stephen Johnson, but I'm pretty sure I've heard it from, I think it might have come from somewhere else. The idea of an intermediate impossible, or impossible intermediate, I can't remember what it is. But this idea of when thinking through, say, something like a strategy, or thinking through how you might tackle a problem or the beginnings of a solution, there's a bit in the middle that you're not really very sure about. You don't even know if it's going to work. But the idea of this sort of intermediate impossible is that we kind of assume, let's assume that's going to work. Let's assume we can solve that and then jump ahead and also kind of work on the thinking after that and then move back. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about with that kind of non-linear path as well?
Yeah, I think we've kind of developed a kind of comfort with that level of ambiguity in design.
Yeah.
Caveat all of this, there's crossover everywhere, everything we're talking about. When I talk about the role or the extra thing that design adds, it's a little bit of freedom to play with these kind of strict boundaries that I think unlocks a whole lot of possibilities that you lose when you try to follow very, very strictly from one step to the other. And in a way, I mean, that's, I guess, the risk that we're kind of talking about here. By becoming very, very process focused, design tends to kind of mitigate that kind of what can be its superpower.
Yeah. And so what are you seeing going on? Because I think this conversation about frameworks started in the comments about something, I think, and talking about frameworks. And there was, you know, I was complaining, I think, about this idea that, you know, I see frameworks as they're very useful. I mean, I teach them, right? So I'm an educator and I train people in service design and other things. And teach at university. And so I'm teaching frameworks. I'm well aware that I do that. And particularly around research, I talk about it and synthesis. They're very useful. But we may need to go, as they say in Sound of Music, back to the very beginning of what we mean by a framework, actually, and before we get onto the sort of crutch aspect of it. But the thing I was complaining about in the comments was this idea that I think I see, you know, I see everyone from students to people working commercially, professionally, sometimes use frameworks without the sort of depth of critical thought behind those frameworks, I guess, and they can become a crutch. And I think when we work at speed, which is obviously there's this kind of massive pressure always, we end up kind of just skimming those things and using those things without kind of much thought. But let's go back to the beginning, because you also wrote a piece about this, but I want to sort of just define our terms. What is a framework in your book?
I was thinking about it a little bit. Actually, I'm quite glad that I came up with a bit of a kind of categorization for this, because when I thought this through, it helped me a lot with some of the, I have some of that same kind of discomfort with, I guess, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I've worked with frameworks and they've almost been the core elements of a strategic output for a long time. Right? A lot of the time when you're working strategy, what you're doing is breaking down ideas and recompiling them in a different way. The outputs are sort of irrelevant. Like, it starts with the core of the idea and how that shifts something. So I've always thought of frameworks as like the engine of my practice. But then over the last few years, I've been getting more uncomfortable, because I've been seeing frameworks become more and more kind of driving what people are doing, and almost driving a kind of completionist type attitude to things. And I think it's taken a lot of the focus off the work. So what I've been trying to do with teams that I've been working with is to say, we need to bring the focus away from the structure of the information that you're working with and actually look at the work. What's the quality of the work? How fit for purpose is it? What is it doing in the job that we're trying to accomplish? So what I've been thinking about is actually the framework is different to a topology or taxonomy. And I think a lot of what we when we're saying framework, a lot of what we're actually talking about is kind of a process or a taxonomy, a kind of a structure for information, but not the information itself. So if you go to, I'm going to pick on jobs to be done. If you look at jobs to be done, a milkshake, the framework would be commute, slow, cold, a certain viscosity, so it's, you know, slow to drink. That's the actual content of the framework. That tells you something about the thing. But the structure of how you write an empty templated jobs to be done, that's not a framework necessarily in this model. That's just a taxonomy. And so I started to think there's a distinction there with like an epistemology, how you do something, a process, and an ontology, like what is the actual thing that you're designing. That distinction helps me massively, because I start to think, well, actually, I'm really focused in thinking about the meaning side of it. And that's useful to have a structure and useful to have a model that describes things. But it's not necessarily the same thing as you should fill out this canvas and then you're going to get to a quality outcome. There's a subtle distinction between them that I think is really helpful.
Yeah, and so, you know, obviously everyone loves a canvas, it seems, or at least us people who write things like a canvas. And, you know, as you know, so the way I think about frameworks, or the primary two that kind of come to mind for me in service design, are things like, jobs to be done is obviously one, but things like journey maps and blueprints, right, are also a kind of framework. I keep trying to sort of emphasize to my students that they're a framework for synthesis, right? They're not really a kind of thing that you are just kind of filling in and it's done. And I kind of hate hearing, I know there's a reason for it, but I kind of hate hearing how, you know, my boss has asked me to design, you know, or the client has asked us to kind of design 3 journey maps or 5, 6 journey maps, or whatever. And that's often procurement driven too. But with this idea of like, there's just a sort of a bunch of these things you can design as artifacts, and that's the kind of end result. And obviously those things are a means to an end anyway. And I think that's probably another thing to remember about frameworks, is that they're a means to an end. But they're a way of taking a lot of messy stuff, say multiple people's, the research of multiple people's journeys through something, and simplifying it and synthesizing it into some kind of structure that that aligns and matches up. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you agree with that, with those as frameworks, or if they're just simply, you know, artifacts of methods.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I think in this kind of process template topology versus framework kind of distinction that I'm using, like the journey map on its own is it's just a grid. Yeah. And that's a template. And so then we've got to be careful with the dangers of that, which is drives a sort of completionism. So, I mean, everybody that's done this kind of work will be familiar. Well, there's blank spaces there. Well, okay, we need to come up with something. Maybe not. Yeah. And so you get more focused on filling out every cell in the canvas than you do in actually thinking about what the content is and is it the right thing for the problem. So the framework would be, well, that the actual content of a particular problem's journey map. And it's useful. This is incredibly useful. The other bit where I think thinking this through a framework is really useful is when, and again, this is kind of framework as embodied knowledge, is when it's an accelerator to understanding a new space. So you come to a problem, whatever it might be, and you downloads a previous kind of piece of work or theory or literature that has already thought through the problem and created a structure of, you know, structured framework around the knowledge in that space. Well, that's, you know, if you haven't ever dealt with that space before, that's a massive accelerator to understanding a new space. And it might also be things that, you know, other people are building off that same theoretical knowledge. And so you're able to kind of collaborate with people better around that space. But that's the knowledge, not the kind of boxes in which we put the knowledge. Yeah. And so I think when you make this distinction, I've almost been, in my notes, I've been writing process and template and framework almost interchangeably, because I think what we're talking about, a lot of it is, if you follow, you know, this set formula, you're going to get to a quality outcome. And that's sort of, I guess, the heart of my problem with this whole space, is that we've removed ourselves a little bit from, you know, examining the work and thinking critically about the work and trying to think about what is needed, what is actually the next thing that you need to do to improve the output of whatever it is that you're trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt and said that it's the conversations in front of a journey map or a blueprint. I mean, you said it in this article, actually. Yeah, you said this thing about, it's a framework's a useful way to kind of order your thinking, right? And I think that one of the things that happens, why I keep coming back to that sort of synthesis, analysis, synthesis stage, because it's probably sort of the really messy stage. There's a kind of ideation end of things too, I think, and the kind of, what should we be doing? We've got a million ideas, where they often come in, and I guess that also comes in at a strategic level too, you're thinking things through, and a framework kind of helps give you some order through which you're thinking. And arguably that's what the kind of business model canvas does. It's not, you know, it's just a, it's also just a grid, but it does a thing where it kind of forces you to think. It's not sort of good housekeeping, forces you to kind of think around all the facets of a particular area in a way that your habit might kind of not get you to. And, you know, and it can kind of help you. And many of those product frameworks are a way to kind of look at that. Some of them kind of take a zoom level up, like SAFe, like Scaled Agile Framework for Enterprise, which, I'm going to just leave that there. But there is a, you know, there's a thing with us. They were not only beloved of kind of product people, they're beloved of management consultants, right, for whom I've worked. I've seen so many kind of frameworks on slides, which kind of seem to consist of a lot of boxes surrounded by some other boxes and arrows from each box pointing to every other box. And I kind of think, okay, in what way does that help? What's that communicating to me? You're just telling me stuff's complicated and everything's related to everything else. And so, you know, there's a point where the framework seems just to become detached from the actual work itself. And it sort of seems to become a thing that helps us to kind of vaguely talk about stuff, but actually the work on the ground really departs from what that framework is supposed to be doing. Have you seen that going? I see that going on all the time.
The distinction that I make around that is probably, actually, it's useful to have a good and a bad, you know, an understanding of just quality or not quality. And that's really, I guess, what I'm trying to kind of build. We're in this idea of kind of judgment or evaluation is actually, you know, looking at the work and going, where does it need to go next? It's largely a matter of going, you know, is it good enough for the purpose that we need? And that's the driver. So rather than the category itself being good or bad in itself, like it's the same thing with process. Like you run a process, it doesn't mean the output is good, right? Like you still have to operate it well to get a good quality outcome. And you've got to look at it and go, did we get a good quality outcome? No, throw it out, start again, or, you know, whatever the case might be. I was looking at some of Lauren Tan's PhD work earlier because I, just thinking about that idea of kind of process, not process. And I remember, you know, she wrote this PhD on DOTS 07. So this is dating me quite a bit. But talking about ideas, and I hadn't clocked this kind of reference as much, but Keir Storst's work on like we rely and have come to rely too much on process. So he had, and again, we can talk, is this a framework or a taxonomy or what is it? But he's talking about the objects of the work, the context of the work, and the actors involved in the work rather than necessarily just the process. And so it's a rebalancing of these kind of priorities and thinking about like, well, actually, if we've lost a little bit of the focus on the work because we've been concentrating on removing ourselves as designers from the work. And, you know, almost kind of anonymizing the design. Anybody can do it. It's, you know, it's a capability that anybody can learn. That's all kind of really noble, but it loses something around how you actually do work. You know, like work happens, a particular piece of work happens by somebody. Yeah. And whether it's a designer or not is kind of irrelevant. But the outcome of the work has a certain quality. And, you know, I think it's sad in a way to lose the expertise of saying somebody that has, you know, put a lot of time and effort into growing a practice around achieving quality outcomes is anonymous or kind of decent. And it's not really, you know, that's not the right terms to kind of talk about decentering or not, but like incorporated in the work or the thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I have done my bit of teaching, you know, training design teams, and it's been often under the guise of, or not non-designers, under the guise of kind of design thinking, which I've always, you know, slightly felt uncomfortable about, felt a bit queasy about. But one of the things I've noticed, and, you know, again, I notice it with students too, partly because at that stage of their careers, that they sort of don't know any better in some respects too, and they're just learning those things. But I certainly see it with professionals is, you know, and I guess the thing about design thinking is you can skim the surface. I notice in coaching too, there's lots of sort of coaching frameworks and things like that. And whenever I've experienced them as a coachee, I've always felt like you can kind of skim, you can go through the steps, but not actually do the work. You can't sort of, and not really get into the depth. So personally, the way I coach is much more, it follows much more of a kind of style that's similar to sort of psychoanalyst style, where, you know, there are some tools and activities, but they're to get us somewhere. Rather than, you know, to sort of fill in the boxes or check the boxes. One of the things that comes up quite often is this idea of how do you know when the framework or the method or the process, and I use those kind of as one sort of bucket more or less, to mean a thing I'm borrowing from someone else or that someone else has done and I'm applying to my work, roughly, you know, to say, you know, someone else has done this, someone else has come up with this framework, this method, this methodology, this is a process, and we're going to use it for our work. And I feel like there's always this question is, it's not working for some reason. If we're not getting the results we're after, how do you develop the critical thinking or the ability to say, you know what, this is the wrong method or the wrong framework to be using for this problem at hand versus we're doing it wrong?
It's interesting because I almost think like it doesn't come up in my practice that the problem doesn't come up in my practice because I'm always treating the framework as the output, not the input.
Right.
So you're always working on it. And so you might borrow a piece from something or a piece from something else, but your focus is continuously on the outcome. It's almost, you know, it's like this piece of the puzzle comes from here and it's working and that piece isn't working. So let's get rid of it. And we'll bring in something else from somewhere else. And that might be completely new. It might be from another piece of work or understanding. But the critical thing is always the question, is it working? I don't know. I feel like maybe it's a glib answer because it seems to kind of skirt the question. But actually, I think it's quite critical to this idea of like, well, actually, that is your role as the kind of developer of this piece of work is to be critically assessing it. I've been thinking a lot. I use software metaphors quite a lot in my thinking. I've been thinking about what a stack might look like where you've got a library that you're using for a particular piece of the puzzle and then another thing that you're using for something else. And you're kind of trying to, I guess, to have a little bit of material honesty about, you know, how those pieces all fit together. And then also, you know, knowing that as you're building that stack up, you're kind of relying on things that, and being clear about where they do and don't work. It sort of gets to, like another one of the tricky bits when you do this, and you maybe kind of go back to the scaled agile example without opening a box of frogs, but what that's trying to do is other frameworks trying to do that same thing is they're trying to add kind of collaboration around a common reference point. And that's incredibly valuable, particularly at scale. So you need to be able to work on multiple pieces of the same problem when you're working at multiple teams. And so there is a call there for, well, let's build some standardization around a particular piece. The tricky bit comes when you are then kind of reliant on a piece of framework that's not working, but is a part of the kind of collaborative engineering, right? So there's how do you be critical about the frameworks that you're using and how you're using them, and how do you build in a bit of interoperability without holding things back? Like you still need to have a kind of a bleeding edge. And so maybe there's this kind of idea of a framework stack, and you know, some teams are running the bleeding edge and other people are running the stable one. And depending on your kind of ability to navigate the kind of edge cases that might come up from using the framework that you're using, you kind of, you select the stack that that you can operate.
There's a Connor just made this comment about, there's a delicate line between using a framework to help build an understanding and around the focus area and overly abstracting it, the information that's actually important. And I kind of feel like there is a relationship here, obviously, between what we're just saying. At the strategic level of things, as you kind of zoom out, you start to look at organizational frameworks, right? And look how this is. So we've got this framework. So this is how we're going to then structure teams and who's going to be in these teams. And this is, and then who is going to be managing those teams. And there are kind of power structures that start to creep in with those frameworks. And again, I feel like those things start to get abstracted from the real work on the ground, like how those teams actually work versus the sort of idealized model of it. And I guess, you know, the more strategic you go, the more that's happening too, right? Where you're getting that kind of abstraction of this seems like kind of a nice idea, but in practice it doesn't work. Mm. Is that a problem for you in the strategic end of things? Partly, maybe, I wonder if there's something to do with the kind of the feedback loop is longer too.
Yeah.
By which I mean, you know, here's a hypothesis about something and then we're going to kind of try and do it and then we get some data in return. once we do it. You know, strategic work, there's a longer kind of feedback loop there.
I think sometimes with the strategic work, there's an output of that strategic work and an impact in a kind of a broader ecosystem that is on a slower cycle. But a lot of the time you get feedback really, really quickly in terms of the cognition of the idea that you're working with. So is it resonating with the team around you? And I think if you shift your idea of strategy from like an idea of this is purely an idea-based thing about something in the future and this kind of romantic idea of strategy too. Strategy is the work on the ground to get people to understand what you're even saying shift the context in which they're trying to think about something. You actually, you have a strategic focus, which is about preparing the ground a lot of the time more than necessarily. So there might be more of like a meso strategic kind of ground that really covers. In the far off strategy world, a lot of the time are actually freer. You know, the stakes aren't the same. And then in the more near term, where you're trying to translate that abstraction into something that teams can actually work with, the practicalities of making it understandable are incredibly critical. So a lot of the time, what I am trying to do, and the framework is, it's an ontological exercise of trying to reframe the way that people are thinking about something.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, what I'm trying to do is isolate the bit of the framework that needs to change and leave the rest unchanged if possible, so that you're reducing the kind of the burden of kind of new understanding and thinking that other people have to do. And just make that really practical. You know, it might be thinking through a new type of way of working for a business unit and just trying to figure out what's the one bit that actually shifts the dial in what they're able to do, and particularly in the near term, that then opens up their ability to actually consume higher orders of abstraction. So, you know, use the rest of their structure. Don't change the whole structure. Change one piece of it, which opens up a new way of kind of thinking or looking or a new kind of practice. You're relying on that practice, that next step, to be the unlocker for the subsequent steps. So, rather than trying to kind of reframe everything in one go, which I think when you're kind of starting out in strategic work, the designer's ego, you're always trying to do that.
Everything's a nail, and you've got the strategy hammer.
100%, yeah. You've solved the whole world and everything, but I think over time you start to try to kind of actually do less and just figure out how you can kind of plug everything in without shifting that much, because you're just trying to kind of unlock the possibilities of the next step. Because if you don't get that first step, you know, the whole future thing is kind of pointless anyway.
I definitely see that it's sort of the Achilles heel of service design, right? Is that wanting to kind of save the world and see everything's connected to everything else. So we have to kind of change the entire system. And for those of people who sort of know systems thinking, Donella Meadows kind of had this sort of list of the, I think it's 14 sort of levers of where to kind of intervene in a system, and in increasing order of effectiveness, but also difficulty. And the bottom one is like change the system. And I notice it with students all the time. Sorry, I feel like I'm picking on my students today. But their projects are kind of like make the world use less plastic and things like that. And it's kind of so massive. And I think once you get maybe a bit older and more experienced and jaded, you're like, I just want to make this tiny bit of the service a bit less rubbish. And that would be a win.
I'll pick on that a little bit because I think sometimes like the piece that you're looking for is the lever point, right? So it's not necessarily just a tiny piece. It's that one little bit of unlock that allows momentum or flow or whatever it is. Yeah. Not to get trapped in the, I just want to make the change I can make. Actually, sometimes, you know, the one small bit is the bit that's actually the critical elements of a larger change.
I mean, I think from a stakeholder management point of view and from sort of design leadership, it's a really crucial thing, right? That, particularly if you're kind of coming into something completely new, it's clearly sort of needs change, but everyone's a little bit stuck on how to do it. I think often changing one or two things that are quite small, but kind of constant irritants, like things that people have been irritated about for ages, and approaching them, you know, and they've been locked up in some way, or some of the reasons why they don't change is because the existing framework actually doesn't sort of consider them a priority or important. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's one of those gap things where two different sort of departments usually feel like the other is responsible for it. And so there's a little gap in the middle where no one really takes care of it. I see that all the time. I mean, I think it's a particular kind of lens of service design to look at those sort of cross-channel things and see the moments where a customer moves from either one step to the next or between channels. There's always these little kind of cracks. I call them sort of like crevasses, right? There's this little crack. Mm. It doesn't seem like much to the organization from the outside, but if you fall down it as a customer, it's a nightmare, right?
Always the handovers.
Yeah, it's always the handovers. Yeah. Transitions. Yeah. I mean, transitions, yeah. I think, are always the biggest problem in whatever direction. And in fact, partly it's because I think the things themselves get taken care of, like the sort of, you know, that exercise that you do in design school sometimes, which can you to draw the negative space, that the spaces between letters or the spaces between objects in order to kind of trick your brain into seeing them differently. That's actually quite a good kind of metaphor for a framework. Yeah. And, you know, looking at those gaps in between is often really important, which kind of maybe brings me on to this idea of the sort of autopilot thing, because I think one of the things that I think design has become a bit kind of process obsessed, or had become a bit process obsessed, and now it's sort of made its way into kind of product design and design systems too. Obviously, another way of kind of operating a little bit on autopilot. I think they're obviously incredibly useful. I understand the kind of reason for them, particularly at scale, and they create great consistency and speed things up an awful lot. Do you feel like there is a kind of aspect though there where you mentioned this kind of monoculture idea that, and I sort of slightly clickbaity in the title of this, said, you know, it leads to boring products and services. I posted a thing on Mastodon a little while ago where I had all the, like, I don't know, I had a bunch of different apps, and they were all some kind of social media thing, whether they were sort of a Twitter-based thing or a Mastodon-based thing or something. And they all just looked the same, right? They all have that same kind of four or five things along the bottom. Perhaps a kind of ribbon up the side. I'm looking at one right now, which has got the same kind of structure. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that kind of increased process focus on design means that, you know, it actually creates kind of things that are pretty bland and boring, that everything starts to look the same? That's such a leading question. It's a terrible research question.
I mean,
you think I'm right about this thing?
It's what everybody wants to hear us. So, I think these things are cyclical. And so if you kind of think about it as increasing layers and then black boxes, and then those are recombined in different ways to get new things, you're always going to reach points of kind of peak something. And then they get recombined in a different way. There's a new kind of thing that gets unlocked. So I don't know that I necessarily, maybe it's an inflection points. I feel like we're at an inflection point for design where, you know, if you look back 10, 20 years, there wasn't good design in every app that you used to do. I mean, there weren't apps for
start. No, weren't apps in my day.
There weren't apps in the way that you think of apps now, right? But there was software and there were services, and the bar was pretty low, and that bar has risen. It's become, I guess, hygiene to have relatively good design in packaging or software design or whatever it is. And so that's resulted in a kind of a plateau. And that's kind of where my thinking is with it. And so part of this kind of, okay, process has got us this far. It's helped us to push the boundaries of what we're doing wider. And more people are consuming good design than maybe in the past. And actually, the volume of things that we're consuming has also gone up. But we maybe need something different for the next step. There's something else that's needed. We need to always have conscious kind of breaks in order to have, And have we got boring things? Yeah, I feel pretty bored with a lot of what we deal with. I think we've sort of run the end of, you know, clean, simple, convenient, these kind of ideas have maybe reached not necessarily like a limit, because I think there's a lot in those ideas, but they're not necessarily easy to achieve. But you can look at almost any category and you'll find two or three that are fairly similar. I did an exercise recently doing a scan for financial services clients, and it was, you know, that like you're always looking for something interesting, and then it was quite interesting looking for the not so interesting things, and actually looking at some of the copycat things in secondary markets was really interesting because they were all the same message over and over again, and it was like, is this somebody that's cleaning up in this context across the whole world by copying and pasting across different markets? Or is it just that these ideas have become so kind of formulaic that if you want to be successful, you have a simple, easy, you know, marketing message. And that's I guess the interesting thing. Like if you then think about, well, what do you do with that? That I don't necessarily have an answer for. So I think that's where we, you know, we need to now start thinking about like, well, if we start reintroducing that kind of idea of good and what is a kind of quality output and go beyond simple and convenient as the only markers of that, how do we start thinking about distinction again? Maybe that allows a little bit more friction, creativity, kind of possibility for distinctiveness in again. And I guess, you know, if I'm right and we're right and we're at this kind of inflection point, maybe our clients need to start looking for that as well. Because they also going to have to look, you know, look different to the next thing for it to be a competitive advantage. It's not an advantage anymore.
Yeah. And so that's the thing with process, right? It is, I guess that's the kind of, you know, culturally strategy for breakfast thing. But it's this idea that, you know, process is kind of easy to copy, right? And everyone seems to be doing it too. But it's the, you know, the execution on it that makes the big difference. And I you see that kind of all the time with copycat things. Jason Massoud, hi, said, you know, feels like SAFE is a great example of something seductive to people for providing a faux simplicity on a complex world. And it kind of feels like that's really where we are with a lot of those things. There's this constant desire to try and linearize and make something complex into something that's complicated, as in a complicated thing, we can kind of take it apart and into its component parts, work on each bit and put it back together again. With obviously complexity, everything is connected to everything else. And if you pull it apart, well, then you kind of just break the whole ecosystem, which I think has been service design's kind of mantra for forever, which is, you know, to think of the ecosystem. I think businesses really struggle with that because they're sort of stuck in an industrial mindset of the way they organize. You know, Nicole just said, hi, Nicole. This thing about, you know, if they, they're useful if sort of they describe how people actually work, but they can often be sort of prescriptive and taken as rules rather than a kind of inspiration. And it seems to me that the real struggle with, I guess sustainability and climate change is the biggest one, where everything really is connected to everything else, which is for businesses to spend the time, I would suggest, on considering the complexity of the problem. And I think frameworks can be very, very useful because they help you explore a complex problem from different ways. They help you force your brains to look in different directions and kind of consider different aspects of things you might inhabit and in speed not always do. But it does feel also that I'm thinking of the canvas of some kind. There needs to be a sort of the box there that's like, what's the maddest version of this? Or what's the thing that kind of completely blows this up or turns it upside down? It's a thing that Mark Curtis, who's one of the co-founders of Fjord, often used to say. It's like, oh, you know what this project needs is a moment of madness, right? where we really kind of just get out of that that sort of process and that routine. But I think that takes time. I think that takes an investment in time to want to do that. I don't think it's a thing that you can kind of do quickly, because you necessarily make the work you're doing really messy again, right? You sort of force yourself back into that messy middle, I think, when you do that. Or do you think, you know, do you disagree or have a different view?
No, I mean, like, that's, I guess, where an example of where they are comfortable. And I can say again, I'm completely uncomfortable with dismissing them because they're such a kind of intrinsic part of the way we work. But how we work with them is critical, right? So if you are you know, insisting that you do this as an exercise at the end of every workshop that you flip it. I worked with somebody years ago who was, you know, had this great, like, you know, make the evil version of it as just as a way of kind of reframing it, or what's the dark version. Or it's a lovely, like, kind of mental flip, but it doesn't work if you do it every single time. And so I think, you know, how do we kind of keep things alive means that we've got to kind of fight against things being stayed. And if your framework is contributing to, again, it's like focusing on the work, if the output that you're getting is feeling dull and boring, maybe you need to inject something else into it. But you've got to be looking at the work to understand whether that's the case or not. So it's the kind of uncritical use of frameworks that's more kind of problematic. I don't know if that means that it's the framework's problem, the operator's problem, but we have a responsibility to, you know, make our processes work for us rather than kind of work for them.
I mean, it's always the operators. It's always a problem between chair and keyboard. You know, there's always the human aspect of it, I think, that where it goes wrong. And I kind of feel like that comes back to this idea of, so I'm going to make a yoga reference here. There's my wife and I have done Iyengar yoga for a long time. She's a teacher as well, actually. And Iyengar yoga uses props, right? And the idea being that it's better to use a block or a chair or something to maintain the integrity of the kind of alignment rather than sort of bend yourself out of shape. But there's also this idea that, you know, when the teacher calls a certain pose, everyone kind of grabs their props kind of automatically. And often a good teacher will go, well, just get rid of the props for a second and see what it feels like without them. Because you know, you used a prop as a beginner, that's fine. But after you've been practicing for sort of 5 or 10 years, why are you still reaching for that without thought? And it feels to me like that's a kind of very, really good sort of analogy for this idea of, you know, reaching for the prop and not really thinking and not really reflecting on you know, what is this achieving for us? And that if there's a sort of thing, I guess, to come out of this conversation is this idea of really sort of pleading, I guess, keep going back to this idea of speed and time, for some time and some part in the process, actually, for reflection and thinking and critical kind of thought, rather than, you know, well, that seems good enough, kind of bang it out and we'll fix it later, which is, I guess, digital's kind of main Achilles heel, is that you can just release something and then fix it up later if it didn't turn out very well. And I think with, say other products and services, and I'm interested in maybe the government work you've done, you kind of can't do that, right? Certainly with kind of physical products, you actually have to do a lot more testing, but you also have to do a lot more kind of critical thinking about what's happening, because it, you know, might kill someone. Is this true in the government work you've done too?
I'm just trying to think if that's necessarily...
Is that true?
I don't know. It depends. It depends on what it is, right? That does have that safety net. I'm not sure I can. It maps directly, because usually the work that I've done has been perhaps a little bit upstream of like an actual medical outcome. And that will need to be there. But actually, you've kind of focused on figuring out the work, and so the feedback loop is more about like trying to figure out what's working than necessarily what's the kind of implemented outcome at a medical level. Like at the service level tends to have slightly different kind of parameters than the medical.
I guess I'm thinking, people can go back and listen to the podcast I did with Kate Tarling, actually, about, so we talked about policy quite a lot, and policy as an act of design, and this idea of actually kind of really thinking through what's the intent here. What might be, because policy is also a framework. You hear about policy frameworks all the time. You know, there's an intent of what we're trying to achieve here, and then how it actually kind of pans out on the ground. And spending the time to really kind of rigorously, critically reflect and analyze that. Because, as you know, the Robo Debt scandal in Australia is a really good example of how something like that can go wrong. People can Google that because we don't have time. But it's, you know, where this idea of a kind of idea up here gets just kind of pushed through almost like a kind of Play-Doh, one of those, you know, those forms that you kind of push Play-Doh through and the kind of spaghetti comes out, and then it all goes wrong.
What it does make me think of is like regulatory frameworks and how they are quite often describe, I mean, designers get kind of hands off about it or scared about it, or it's this compliance thing that needs to go, you know, that's a step down the line that we've got to kind of pass. But actually, a lot of the time, you know, that framework has a spirit, and it's actually quite close to what we're trying to do a lot of the time. Like, it's trying to protect consumers or protect people that are using it. And so it has an outcome in mind, but then it tries to wrap it in a particular kind of framework, and people then start adhering to the framework. Whereas actually, if you step back from that and say, well, what's the intent of this, and what are you trying to actually accomplish with this? A lot of the time you can actually go quite, you know, you can marry the best outcome for the person who's impacted to the spirit of the law. And that's something to kind of always hold to, that like spirit versus the letter. And maybe that's the same thing for frameworks. It's like, well, what's the spirit of this framework? And how do I kind of consume that and interpret it in my own practice rather than just kind of follow the letter of it?
I remember working on I think I mentioned this in the Kate Tarling podcast, actually, that the there was a project I worked on for a large government organization, public organization in government organization in Australia. And there was this thing that kept coming up where in workshops, and we can't do that because, you know, policy. And eventually we got the policy person in, and every time that came up, they went, no, it's really not policy. People kept saying that's the law. And I said, no, there's the law. Here's our policy as a response to that law. And then here's how we've kind of, this gets interpreted by us all the time as kind of the dogma. And there's these different levels, and it gets sort of narrower and narrower, more fixed the further down you go. And as you're saying, if you actually take the effort and time to kind of step up a level, you actually get much more wiggle room in terms of the things you can explore.
Absolutely. If designers aren't reading the regulations themselves, they're missing a trick. I keep detailed notes about all the regulatory frameworks, because usually, you know, there's the legal teams and the compliance teams, and they're kind of quite first in the letter of it. But there's a lot of other people that are kind of, it's almost hearsay around the edges. And you can kind of go quite quickly through that.
Actually, one of the things that we found when we were doing research on this was the end users of this service, I can't say who it was, but the end users of this service, the way that people kind of knew, oh, this is what you can and can't do, was because of a Facebook group. It's kind of a language problem and a design problem, in that the policy documents are so sort of arcane and opaque in the language that they were written in, that it was sort of reinterpreted, and the simplified version was the thing that was circulating on Facebook, and a lot of it was wrong. A lot of it really was hearsay, you know. And then it just sort of becomes the norm.
The classic of like post-it notes in the call center. That's the kind of actual source of truth, not the
exactly,
not the policy.
So look, we're coming up for time. What are your hopes for Path?
We've got quite a lot going on. Trying to 2 years old studio, largely me as a practitioner, and intentionally kind of keeping it small and working with networks of people, but trying to work at finding what the right kind of fit is, and in the context of, I guess, a market that has shifted a lot from kind of buying projects from agencies to building a lot in-house, and experimenting a lot to try to kind of find the right kind of way of working with that market. And then, I mean, it's interesting talking about frameworks, because building a lot and trying to kind of embed some stuff into some tools. And so frameworks kind of come up as a kind of a key part of that. It's almost the kind of intellectual bedrock of whatever it is that you're trying to build. So I'm trying to build a lot, build a practice, and then working with some really interesting clients to kind of implement some of these things at scale, which is this really great kind of testing bed.
Yeah.
So the way I look at it is, I guess product market fit's not a bad kind of idea for the way the practice is evolving. We're kind of working at trying to find the right fit for, like, it's a vehicle that helps keep trying to kind of grow things and do things a little bit differently all the time, and kind of keep on the edge of evolving things, which is where I'm kind of happy about process when I'm kind of doing something new or different or kind of evolving something.
And clients mostly in Australia or all over the world?
Mostly in Australia, a little bit of a mix, but yeah, a lot of kind of large financial services companies is probably the mainstay of it. Which, if you know Australia, that's the
it's quite a lot
the kind of the bulk of the market here. But also, you know, big problems around scale, and so that's the elements of my practice that I think is kind of the most interesting and challenging is how do you kind of take these kind of practices and then grow them out across large teams, large kind of volumes or quantity of work, and a lot of my practices at that kind of thinking about a portfolio of work and how it all knits together, not necessarily just kind of individual pieces.
So the show is named after the Ray and Charles Eames film Powers of 10, which is all about the relative size of things in the universe, which is for me the kind of the most useful metaphor for service design on that idea of kind of moving between different levels of Zoom and the kind of similarities actually and kind of echoes there. And so the very last question is always what one small thing is either overlooked or could be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
This is a glib answer, but it's something I've just been thinking about a lot. I'm really interested in, I don't know if this is a small thing, maybe this isn't a small thing at all, but how batteries kind of flow, like battery flow, and how there's this kind of behavioral piece around batteries that as we kind of get more used to batteries, we're kind of embedding them in everything and they all become interconnected with each other. And so this is things like getting the grid connected up with your car so that you're kind of charging at the right times. And I got obsessed a little while ago about how this flows all the way down to kind of, you know, charging headphones off your phone or, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I like it as a problem because it's such a kind of clear behavior and technology and system kind of example. So it feels like there's something kind of interesting in this, like thinking about the power grid as something that you kind of carry with you that's like a really nice kind of interconnected small thing that goes to a bigger thing.
Yeah, charging and charges, they're a kind of interesting space at the moment. I mean, obviously in automotive world, there's a big thing going on there. You know, it seems likely that Tesla is going to be a charger company, perhaps more so than it is a car company. It's interesting to see. Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10. Where can people find you? Where's the best place? Is it Path or is it...
The best place is my website, pathventures.io. I use it quite extensively, and there's a bit of kind of framework tools stuff that I'll be releasing soon. Yeah. There's quite a bit of stuff there that's nearly ready to be shared.
And on social media, LinkedIn is the kind of the main place.
Yeah, these days, I'm kind of checked out of almost everything else.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for being my guest on Power 10.
It's lovely, Andy. Thanks for the chat. It's been really good.
So if you've been watching and listening to Power of 10, if you would like to find anything more, you can find, search my name, A. Pullane, really, everywhere. You'll find me on Mastodon. I've kind of pretty much given up on Twitter. You'll find all the show links at pullane.com, where you can find more episodes. You can check out my leadership coaching practice, online courses, sign up for my very irregular newsletter. I need to try and make it become more regular, called Doctor's Note. If you're looking at this on YouTube, there's a whole bunch of more stuff that I'm going to be doing on YouTube. So give it a thumbs up or subscribe. If you've got any thoughts, put them in the comments. I know for many people, this live stream was very early in the morning. And for the Americans, you'll all be asleep. So if you've got any thoughts about it, then pop a comment in and I can respond. That's the nice thing about YouTube versus the podcast. This will also appear on the podcast feed. All the links will be in the show notes down there. Thanks for listening and watching, and I'll see you next time.